Well, welcome everybody to the latest episode of Star Cells and God. This is the podcast where we explore how the latest discoveries that are taking place at the frontiers of science provide evidence for God's existence and the reliability of Scripture. My name is Fuzz Rana. I am a biochemist and a Christian apologist, and I work for an organization called Reasons to Believe, which sponsors this podcast. If you want to know more about Reasons to Believe, go to our website, www.reasons.org. Also, you can follow us on social media, RTB_official. And then last but not least, you can go to our YouTube channel, Reasons to Believe, and subscribe. There you will get all of the back episodes of Star Cells and God, along with other video content that address a wide range of issues in the science-faith dialogue. And then while you're there, don't forget to subscribe and use the notification button so that you will be alerted when the next episode of Star Cells and God drops. Today we have a special episode for you, and you're going to want to watch this one. This is a replay of an interview carried out by Dr. Andy Brow and Dr. David Block with the world-renowned astronomer Giovanni Fazio. Dr. David Block is the director of RTB Africa, and they have their own podcast. And in this particular episode, Dr. Block interviews Giovanni Fazio. Giovanni Fazio is a leading light in astronomy. He is one of the pioneers in infrared astronomy, having experiments on board the space shuttle, also playing a critical role in the design of the Spitzer Space Telescope. He currently holds positions at both the Harvard and Smithsonian Observatories. It's an interesting conversation because he and David Block are good friends. They are, in fact, collaborated on a set of experiments designed to characterize the Andromeda galaxy. And then finally, they are also brothers in Christ, where they have a wide-ranging conversation where they talk about Giovanni Fazio's career in astronomy, about their friendship, their collaboration, and their perspectives on how science provides support for the Christian faith. So enjoy this replay of this incredible interview. I'm sure you're going to love it.
Hello and welcome everybody to this, our first podcast of Reasons to Believe Africa, probing sound science and testable truth. It's my absolute pleasure to welcome my friend and colleague of many, many years, Professor David Block. Many of you will know he is the Emeritus Professor of Applied Mathematics. He's an astronomer and more recently appointed as the Director for Reasons to Believe Africa. David, thank you for joining us on this first podcast.
Thank you so much, Andy. It's a greatest of joys to be here with you and with my dearest friend, Professor Fazio.
Well, David, won't you go ahead and just introduce Professor Fazio and then we'll get right into it.
Certainly. Giovanni Fazio is one of the greatest legends, I would say, in the domain of infrared astronomy. He served as principal investigator for the first infrared astronomical telescope to fly on the Spacelab 2 flight of the space shuttle. That was way back, Andy, in 1985. But our collaboration really started years later, because in 1984, Giovanni Fazio was elected principal investigator of the infrared array camera known as IRAC, which was on board the Spitzer Space Telescope, one of NASA's great observatories. The Spitzer Space Telescope was launched in 2003, as I recall. But what's extremely interesting about Professor Fazio are his awards. Just to name but two of them, Andy, the Royal Society of London Co-Spa Massey Award, the gold medal, which was awarded in 2008. And then, perhaps even more prestigious or equally prestigious, was the Henry Norris Russell Lectureship in 2015, which is awarded to the best of the best. His current research interests include galaxies, star formation, black holes, ultra-luminous galaxies, brown dwarfs, and so on. But this is the legend we have in front of us, and my dearest friend and collaborator, and it's just awesome to have him here, Andy.
Thank you so much, David. So, Professor Fazio, I want to take you back to the very early 1960s when you joined what was then the Smithsonian Astrophysical Observatory and the Harvard College Observatory. Just tell us a little bit about that research and some of the conditions under which you worked back in those formative years, if you would, please, Professor.
Okay, thanks, Andy, and thanks very much, David, for your very generous introduction. It was very kind of you. I wasn't trained as an astronomer, and in fact, I've never had an astronomy course in my life. I was trained as an elementary particle physicist, and when I went to my first position as at the University of Rochester on the faculty there, we read an article by a very famous professor, Philip Morrison at Cornell University, what appeared to be two galaxies in collision. It was a strong source of radio called Cygnus A, and the image of Cygnus A looked like two colliding galaxies together. So Philip Morrison suggested that this could be a matter-antimatter galaxies in collision. And as they were producing copious gamma rays, being an elementary particle physicist with instrumentation, we said, we can detect those gamma rays very easily. So we dropped my elementary particle physics and went after this unusual source in the sky. Well, it was a long story after that. So what we had to do is, because gamma rays were absorbed by the atmosphere, we had to build a gamma ray detector, which we knew how to do, but then we had to fly it in a high altitude balloon because the gamma rays were absorbed by the atmosphere. So we did that right away. This was in 1959. And we flew them, and we found nothing. And every time I'd go up, I'd set a new lower limit. And this went on for 10 years, actually, and kept setting, but we never detected. It turned out it wasn't a two galaxies in collision, but just an elliptical galaxy with a dust band across it. That changed me from elementary particle physics to astronomy. I was hooked then on doing this, even though doing gamma ray astronomy at that time was extremely difficult. But I did get to put a gamma ray detector on NASA's orbiting solar observatory to look for gamma rays from the sun, which we did, and that was launched in 1962. So I've been flying space missions for almost over, doing either high altitude balloon flights or space missions for 65 years now,
and
enjoying it very much. I'm still at it now. I just turned 90 this year, but still going and working full time. But anyway. After that year, I then decided to branch out into ultra-high energy gamma ray astronomy, where ultra-high energy gamma ray astronomy can be done from the ground because the gamma rays are so energetic, they interact in the atmosphere, causing what is called a particle shower, and this can be detected on the ground. So again, and I built a 10-meter reflector, optical reflector, out in Mount Hopkins, Arizona, just south of Tucson, to look for the gamma rays there. And so we looked, and at the Crab Nebula, a supernova that had occurred, and we looked for 3 years and got a 3-sigma effect. So after 1 year of tracing high altitude, low energy gamma rays, and then another 5 years or so trying to trace ultra high energies, and that I said, this has got to stop. I said, the amount of work divided by the number of photons I was detecting approached infinity. So I said, this has got to, so it got to change. And since I knew how to fly balloons, I decided to go into infrared astronomy. This was about 1970 or so. I did this, that turned something I never regret, and it turned out to be very, very promising. So what I did is I built a 1-meter Loon-Bourne telescope for far infrared astronomy. Professor Frank Lowe was sort of the father of infrared astronomy, helped me with the mirror and the detectors and everything. And jointly, we got that going. And that really turned out to be incredibly productive. We mapped for the first time in the far infrared many H2 regions in our galaxy. These are star-forming regions, ionized star-forming regions in our galaxy. Mapped them for the first time in far infrared wavelengths, and produced. That went on for 20 years. That flight, and I think I flew about 19 flights with it, and just say extremely productive. And so it led into my introduction into infrared astronomy, and many of the graduate students who have worked on that. For example, Ned Wright, who later on flew his own infrared telescope mission for NASA, and also George Ricci, who worked on Spitzer with me, and also is now one of the builders of the MIRI instrument on the James Webb telescope. So a lot of interesting graduate students, very productive there.
Some of the best in the world, Giovanni.
Yeah. So I'm very proud of that also, I must say, as much as my scientific achievement.
Yeah.
But anyway, that led to my, as David announced, led to my flight of an infrared telescope on the space shuttle. And the object there was to send something up. It was the whole Space Lab 2 flight was devoted to science. I think there were 11 or 12 experiments, X-ray, cosmic ray, plasma physics. But what it turned out to be that the space shuttle is really like a little comet. Water gets absorbed in the tiles and is then emitted when it gets into space. So there's a cloud of water vapor around the shuttle, and that's a death knell for infrared astronomy, because water vapor absorbs infrared radiation. And also we saw paint flecks and bolts and nuts and coming out of the shuttle, drifting by the telescope. And that was the end of that. But it really showed that NASA wanted to do infrared astronomy from the shuttle, but that proved that that was not feasible. X-ray astronomy can be done, and cosmic ray work can be done, but not infrared astronomy. Mm. So then NASA decided to instead launch a infrared telescope. At the time, it was called the Space Infrared Telescope. First into a high orbit, 10,000 kilometer orbit, and then they decided to launch the Spitzer. Well, at the time, it was called the Space Infrared Telescope Facility, and that was eventually. Proposed in the in the actually it was the late 70s and early 80s, and then the call for investigators went out in 1983, and I applied, as David said, in 84, and with the infrared array camera, and won that, and that mission was launched, as David said, in 2003. It lasted 16 and a half years. It was only built for 5 years, and just, I mean, Spitzer changed our view of the universe. There's just no question. And the infrared ray camera was still working at the end, and eventually NASA just turned it off because Webb's was coming along, and it was getting more difficult to communicate with it because it was in a solar orbit following the Earth. And so we turned it off. I tried to keep it going by getting private donations, but was not successful in trying to do that.
Professor Fazio, just enlighten us on specifically the penetrating power of infrared astronomy. So for people who may not be aware of that particular technology, what is it that makes infrared astronomy so special in your view?
Yeah, that's a very good question. Let me say the infrared radiation is the radiation just beyond the red part in the electromagnetic spectrum. It's radiation we cannot see with our eyes.
Yes.
And so most of the spectrum, not all of it, but most of the spectrum is absorbed by the atmosphere, and we have to go up above the atmosphere to see it. But the question that you raised, why is it so important? Well, there's several reasons. One is you can see galaxies at very great distances. The universe is expanding. And as a result of that, galaxies, the further a galaxy away it is, the faster it's moving and away from us. And due to the expansion of the universe, the light, the white light from a galaxy is stretched due to the expansion. It ends up in the infrared. So if you want to see galaxies at the beginning of the universe, you have to go into the infrared. And that's one reason. The second reason is that infrared radiation can penetrate dust. As David well knows, and is one of the experts on this, but that's one of his advantages. Optical light can't get out. So if you want to see stars born in their very dense clouds of gas and dust, you have to go to the infrared. And the infrared, the dust also emits in the infrared. That's another reason. And so many things in the universe are blocked by dust. We can't see. Hubble can't see them. But Spitzer and now JWST, James Webb Space Telescope, can see it. And then the last reason is that many molecules vibrate in the at infrared wavelengths, particularly infrared molecules that would be critical to discovering life elsewhere in the universe. For example, like carbon dioxide, water, ozone, methane. And so if you want to look for life in the universe, the best place to do it is in the infrared. So those are the primary reasons why it's so exciting.
Thanks, Professor. I know that you have a reputation as the father of the IRAC, the infrared array camera, but closer to our conversation today, you've also worked with Professor David Block on the history of the Andromeda galaxy. I'd love to just see the two of you reminisce on some of that, particularly leading up to the publication of the journal article in Nature. So David, maybe you start, and then we'll go back to Professor Fazio.
Well, it was one of my greatest joys. It's always been one of my greatest joys, Andy, to collaborate with Giovanni Fazio, simply because he's like Professor Chris Barnard was in heart surgery with the heart transplants. You know, his knowledge is encyclopedic, as you can hear. He's mentally so astute. And so years ago, I said to Giovanni, with my great interest in cosmic dust, I said to him, you know, I wonder what the Andromeda Spiral Galaxy, which is 2.2 million light years away from us, I wonder what that would look like in infrared light. It was just a kind of a hunch I had. What does it actually look like? What can we expect to see? Will we expect to see a normal spiral galaxy, or will there be untold, lurking mysteries suddenly unfolding before our eyes? And so I approached Prof. Fazio, and I said to him, Giovanni, I have this little nudge. Can you help me? I'd love to have the Andromeda Galaxy observed by the Spitzer Space Telescope and IRAC, but in the infrared. And Giovanni, as always, I've stayed in his home many, many times near Harvard, as always, was just so generous with his time and expertise. And he sent my team and myself, he was part of the team, of course, one of the images of the Andromeda Spiral Galaxy. And my jaws nearly fell wide open because I saw something which basically, Giovanni, correct me if I'm wrong, but it hadn't been detected before, and that is that there was almost a head-on collision. Giovanni was speaking about colliding galaxies. There's almost a head-on collision, not 13 billion years away, but right on our doorstep. I mean, this was almost unimaginable, a collision right here on our doorstep, 2 million light years away, not billions of light years away. And I saw these glowing rings of fire. As Giovanni says, the dust starts glowing in the infrared. And I could see that the interloper, the galaxy which had caused this almost head-on collision was a small little galaxy called Messier 32, which had rammed into Messier 31. And so the whole history unfolded, and the result was published in Nature. And in fact, we flew Giovanni Fazio to Johannesburg, and he was at the international press conference, which was hosted by SAPA, Reuters, and this was announced worldwide, the discovery. But right behind this discovery at every single step was my dearest collaborator and dearest friend, Giovanni. So he might like to also add to some of the excitement in those days.
Okay, yeah, that was really quite something. David led this effort, and I thank him for getting me involved with it and everything, but it is also one of my outstanding results from the infrared array camera. I never remember, I'll never forget going to work that morning in Johannesburg to see David. And along the way, I see the paper, newspapers advertised being posted. And there above the fold was, you know, astronomer finds collision, galaxy collision, or something like that. I forget what the exact words were, but anyway, that was quite something for me. Yeah, so
I remember it said Vitsprof solves galaxy puzzles or something like that. But yeah, it was so funny. I mean, there you were. We were driving in the car, and you saw this, as you say, above the fold and on the street poles. I was very thrilled about that, Giovanni, because it's not often that astronomical research is featured in the same level of interest as, say, President A meeting King B or so on.
Yeah, and then we gave a fantastic talk at the auditorium with Walter Rand University, which was really fun. I recall also, David, that was a great. Yeah, David and I both shared the stage there, and that was a lot of fun. I loved working with David. He's always excited and got me more involved in galaxies, and I'm very appreciative of that.
And that's one of the things, Professor Fazio, that I wanted to. One of the things I wanted to ask you was, Professor Block brought out the book that was co-authored with Professor Ken Freeman, God and Galileo. And Professor Fazio, you endorsed that book. So that leads me to my next question of your understanding of the hand of God in all of this in terms of creation. Where do you stand on all of that?
Yeah, no, I do. You know, most of the people I work with are either agnostic or atheist. And that seems to prevail through the upper echelons of science. And I consider myself a very religious person. I'm a Roman Catholic, practicing Roman Catholic. And I find no conflict with religion and science. And in fact, when I give a talk on the origin of the universe and everything, I always put it, you know, make the comment at the end in that several things. First of all, when you look at the universe and you see where we are in it and our position, and the first reaction is, wow, we are nothing. We are just a little pinpoint, a dot, nothing, you know, a dust grain in the universe. But then I say, looky, with a few kilograms of gray matter above in our head, we were able to contemplate what the universe looked like. And this is a miraculous thing. This is an amazing thing. We don't fully appreciate that. And again, you know, that's, I look upon that as being a gift of God that we're able to do that. And the second thing, when you look at the universe, although it appears randomly, there's incredible order in it and uniformity and beauty. And that, again, I find just doesn't appear randomly. I remember when I was in my Catholic grade school or elementary school, as you would call it, and the nuns would give us the example, you know, if you're walking along the beach and all of a sudden you find a watch in the sand, you pick up the watch, you look at it, you open it up, and you see this incredible mechanism on the inside. And you say to yourself, wow, some intelligent being must have assembled this. This didn't randomly appear in the sand. And so that's another example I still remember from elementary school, that when I look at the universe, I see the hand of God in it. I mean, I don't see how anybody cannot, but most people don't, I'm afraid.
So, Professor Fugger, enlighten us on that. How do you understand this notion of the hand of God in creation?
Well, I said although we claim we know an awful lot about how the universe formed and everything, you know, there's beginning to be some cracks opening up that question whether we really do or not. But there's things like, where did the universe come from? You know, how did this start? Or did it start at all? Maybe it was always there. You know, so like I said, you see this, and there must be some, at least in my mind, my thinking, there must be some supreme being that either got this started or is guiding it. You know, where did the laws of physics come from? So, why do we have such laws? And, you know, somebody must have established such order and everything. I find it just difficult that the laws of physics appeared randomly, you know. Anyway, so.
David, you wanted
to touch on a very, sorry, Andy. I think you're touching on a very important point there, Giovanni, is that where do these laws of physics come from? I mean, the fine tuning, as we well know, if you change the 55th decimal place and you monkey with that, we wouldn't be here. The same for the forces operative in the atom, the weak nuclear force and the strong nuclear force. So I think you and I are in the same camp, that we see evidence for design screaming out at us. Would you agree?
Yeah, David is right. You know, just any little change, and really small change in the way things are, would make it impossible for human beings to exist. We would have never existed. And I don't find it a problem. I don't find it a conflict with my work. And in fact, just the opposite. I often thank God for for what He gave me, for my mind, and I was able to work as long as I can and still keep going. You know, so.
So Giovanni, let's think about the recent infrared observations that have come through with the James Webb Space Telescope. You did reference it earlier. How do you think a telescope like that helps us to answer some of these grand questions around cosmology and astronomy?
Okay, yeah. My answer to that is two very interesting things. First of all, the James Webb Space, I'll call it JWST just to shorten it. There's two things, two very important things it's going to do related to your question. One of them is to find out where the first stars and the first galaxies came from. Where did the universe come from? Like I said, because it's in infrared radiation, it can penetrate to the first galaxies and the first stars. It can go that far. It's the first telescope that can do that. The Spitzer Space Telescope went very deep. And I was on one of the papers that found the furthest galaxy. You know, when I say furthest galaxy, that means we're looking back in time due to the transit time of light. And so we found a galaxy that was formed galaxy already 400 million years after the Big Bang. That's hard. And theoreticians thought it would take at least a billion years to form the first galaxy. And here we found one formed at 400 years. Now, Webb has even gone back further now to around 300 million years back in time. And so that's one thing. We're really... How can we say we're probing into God's space with our finger or something, right?
Wow.
Yeah, you know, we're beginning to to see how the universe formed. And
wow.
I hope we can do that. We probably won't see the first stars, but I think we'll see the first galaxy. Hopefully we'll see some of the first galaxies that form. And the whole question is, how did all this happen? How did we end up with beautiful objects like the Milky Way or the Andromeda Nebula? How did they form? What happened? So we're beginning to see that. But the other interesting thing is, the more we dig deep into this and try to understand it, the more questions appear. It just goes on and on. It just shows the infinite problem that we're dealing with. But anyway, so that's one thing. I hope James Webb will lead to understanding how the universe formed.
Wow.
And that's an important question, I think, both physically and theoretically.
Yes.
And also from a religious standpoint.
Yes. Giovanni, would you say that there's a beautiful harmony between the book of Genesis, in the beginning God creates the universe, and there was light, which is not the sun, but there was light, the radiation-dominated epoch. Would you say you find the harmony or the accord between the description of God creating the universe and what James Webb and Spitzer has revealed in beautiful harmony? What are your thoughts?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. I've spent a lot of time trying to relate what happened in Genesis to actual, thing, but it's quite difficult to do. But I find it in complete harmony. I find no problem at all with that. That creation.
And what's also very interesting is that, I mean, it's incredible. The author of Genesis could never have just guessed humanly that there would be light before the first stars and galaxies.
Yes,
our understanding of the Big Bang, the creation event, is that the universe initially is flooded with electromagnetic radiation.
That's
astonishing.
Yes, yeah. The question is, where did that energy come from,
Yes.
Where did all that energy that formed the universe? It was all energy in the beginning when it began.
Yes.
It could be that it always was there and always existed. That's the so-called solid state model. Not solid, excuse me, steady state.
Steady state.
Yeah. the steady state model that says the universe was always there. And in the beginning it was all energy. The question is, where did that energy come from?
Yes.
And then that energy turned into matter. And because Einstein says energy and matter are equivalent. And so eventually that happened. But as David said, in the beginning, it was all radiation. There's no conflict with the Genesis sequence and everything. You just have to interpret it in the proper way.
That's key.
Yeah. David, I remember as a young teenager sitting in an auditorium when you were still using slides, and you gave us a presentation called "From Psalm 19: The Heavens Declare the Glory of God."
Yes. Yeah.
And I wonder, Giovanni, what's your thoughts as you hear that phrase?
Yeah, no, I fully agree with the phrase, and like I said earlier, you just look at the universe, look at the beauty, the wonder, as we said, just one little change. If the charge of the electron was just a little different, we wouldn't be here, right? I mean, so why is that? You know, it just can't just appear randomly. I find that very difficult to believe, and the beauty. Look at that picture behind David. I mean, you know, that's spectacular. Amazing. Let me say there's another thing also that I wanted to bring up was another reason is not only the structure and the origin of the universe, where it came from, but also JWST will go at another problem that we're trying to solve. It is looking for life in the universe and evidence for life in the universe. As I said, because infrared radiation can detect the molecules that are critical for proving that their life exists. James Webb is going to make a deep insight into, I think, whether we can find life in the universe or not. And so looking forward to that. And of course, whether it exists or not has got very theological great consequences. And again, whether we find it or don't find it, it opens up many theological questions. And even the mere fact that life exists as we know it is another proof in my mind. Yeah.
It's another miracle in its own right, isn't it, Giovanni? I mean, against all odds, just the charge of the electron alone, against all odds, there is a Giovanni Fazio, there is an Andy, there is a David, against all odds. That alone, which, as you know, led to the anthropic cosmological argument, is that we are here. We should not be unaccountable. All the laws of physics, we shouldn't be here. Do you agree?
Yeah. No, it's that's right. And I find it difficult that this just appeared randomly. I also, you know, when you look at the arguments, we think that every star has planets around it. Probably every star has planets around it. And maybe 10 or 20% of them have Earth-like planets around them. And so you consider there's 200 billion stars in our Milky Way galaxy that you see behind David there, and 200 billion galaxies in the universe. So your immediate conclusion is, well, gee, life must be very, very abundant. But there's the so-called Fermi paradox that where the hell is it, you know?
That's right.
They've been around much, much longer than we have. We're actually new kids on the block in the universe, right? We should see it all around us. We should, in principle, but we don't.
We don't.
No.
I've always said in my books, Giovanni, that I wouldn't be surprised if life in very primitive forms exists elsewhere. But whether self-aware, self-conscious human beings like you and I, who can actually, as you said earlier, understand cosmology and observe the universe, whether they exist or not. I wouldn't be surprised in a sense if it's Imago Dei. In other words, God creates us in his image, and we are unique. And we are unique in many ways, including to understand the history of the cosmos, yeah. to back yeah. at the most distant galaxies and the beginnings of the universe. Your thoughts on that?
Yeah. I at first went along with this argument that there should be life everywhere in the universe. And but now I'm beginning to believe that we may be alone.
Yes. Wow, that's astonishing.
Yeah, I haven't come around 100%, but I'm about 90% there, I think. There's too many. I just find out too many. What really I in the past, I've sat down, I've formed groups of scientists and theologians to discuss what we did is we had the theologians tell us what they're working on, and we told the theologians what's going on in science. And that I found those really enjoyable and exciting episodes. And I still stay in contact with theologians, and we exchange ideas. But one of the questions that I ask them, I believe in evolution. I'm a strong believer in evolution. But my question is, when did the soul, or when did the intellect, consciousness appear in the evolution cycle? Mm-hmm. You know, when did it all of a sudden appear in evolution? Or just how did that how did that evolve? How did consciousness, free will evolve in evolution? And that's a question that really bothers me, and I've received no answer yet. Except there is one interesting book called The Divine Milieu by a Jesuit, Théodore de Chardin, and he has proposed that consciousness or free will is in every living thing, but only in different degrees, which I find is a fascinating concept, and that would solve my problem. Anyway, so that's something that really bothers me, and I still try to get some discussion on.
But you know, it's so interesting. Sorry, Andy, it's so interesting because maybe the spirit didn't evolve. Maybe God breathes into us at some time, maybe 100,000 years ago, 150. Maybe God breathes into us his spirit, as Genesis says, and we become a living soul. Maybe that, you know, once we agree that the universe is created, in other words, that there's a great designer behind it all, it's part of his master plan, is it not, Giovanni, to institute within us free will and the spirit. I mean, when we die, our spirit does not die. So I think that could be a very harmonious accord with God creating the universe and using the mechanisms, whichever mechanisms he does use, and then God creating the marvel of Giovanni Fazio.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot to learn yet.
Giovanni, what I'm impressed by is that at 90, you're still asking, you're still seeking,
yes.
you're still looking to the Lord for deep revelation, not just through telescopes, but spiritually.
Yeah.
That doesn't seem to be something that I see all astronomers doing. In fact, many of them are often blinded spiritually. Your thoughts on that?
No. Like I said before, most of the people I work with, and in fact, you don't bring up religion at the observatory. Right? You don't bring religious speakers at the observatory, you know. And but no, in my life, too many things happened in my life that that without God's hand would have never occurred. I mean, I came from nothing. My parents had no high school education, even. My father was an Italian immigrant. My mother's family came from Italy. There were no books in our house when I was growing up. We had a Funk and Wagnalls dictionary, a small encyclopedia. But there were no books in my house when I was growing up. And so how in the world did I ever end up in this position, you know, where I am right now? The degree from MIT and working at Harvard and the Smithsonian. So, you know, it's got to be the hand of God guiding me all the way. And I acknowledge that. And I thank God often for giving me all the gifts that I have.
Wonderful. Something that David and I have spoken about before, Professor Fazio, is Christmas is upon us. Our thoughts turn towards the Star of Bethlehem, the Christmas star. As an astronomer, do you have any perspective on what that star is or could have been?
Oh, I'm glad you brought that up. Boy, do I. I've looked into that quite a bit. That one really is another one that fascinates me. I've gone back into the Bible in several places and tried to make connections with astronomy. But that one really fascinates me. You know, the idea of it being a comet has approached up, a supernova exploding. There's a book, I forget the star, it's called The Star of Bethlehem. It's by a professor whose name, I forget right now, a professor at the University of New Jersey. And He has the best explanation that I've seen. And he says, basically, looky, the three kings were astrologers. They were astrologers. So they looked at the stars. They knew the stars and everything. And it turns out that in astrology, there were, if I remember right, I haven't gone back to this recently, but something about if there's a certain conjunction of stars, that means that a king is being born, something like this. And so they followed this star. It wasn't a particular star, but a conjunction of a planet. A conjunction of planets.
Conjunction of planets.
Yeah, sorry, I missed my. I meant a conjunction of planets. Yes. Yeah, that there, if a certain conjunction of planets occurred that there'd be some unusual occurrence going to happen, you know, and they were really out after that. That conjunction occurred, and they were out after. To seek the origin, you know, I mean, what that event was. And I find that, you know, quite appealing. It's a natural thing they would be doing. It wasn't something, and you know, and that's what they traced. And they make they show there was such a conjunction, you know, at the time of Christ. Let's see. There was another thing. It was in the. I think I got this right, but don't quote me on it. That the conjunction was in Aquarius. And it's got a special meaning, and I think I got the right constellation. But anyway, and it occurred in that, and that constellation was connected with the. With the concept that it was going to be a savior or you know, being born and everything, so I find that's one of the best explanations I've found.
Brilliant.
I think that what's so interesting, Giovanni, is that whatever the Star of Bethlehem turns out to be, the lineup of the planets is certainly one explanation. But I think the beautiful thing is that at this time of, as Andy says, Christmas approaching, it reminds me of the first chapter in John. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was made flesh and tabernacled amongst us. That's really incredible that the Creator should transcend time and space and become immanent, that we can touch Him and behold His glory. That to me is the greatest, of course, of miracles. Just the Star of Bethlehem.
That's an incredible event. Yes, incredible event. Yeah, absolutely.
Professor Fazio, as we come towards the end of a discussion that I know could go on for weeks, if not years, one of the things that David and I wanted to ask you was, for any young physicist or astronomer watching this interview, what advice would you have for them?
Yeah. What I tell graduate students when they walk into my office for the first time is, I said, you know, when you leave here and you graduate, I said, and get a job, find a job that you enjoy, that you want to go to work on Monday morning.
Mm.
Because if you don't, life is hell.
Mm. Life is then hell.
Yeah. If you don't love your work, life is hell. So I think that's quite important. And and also you really, yeah, so you got to find a field and find an area that you really enjoy and love doing. And I think that keeps the motive, that keeps me going, because I mean, I tell people I love to go to work on Monday and they think I'm crazy, you know.
Giovanni, I'm very curious to ask you. I mean, in South Africa anyway, many people reach the age of 65, as Andy knows, and they sort of retire. They stop thinking, they go into aged old age homes, and they perish by the age of 70 or 72 or so on. They're gone. Here you are, a marvel at 90, and you're so astute. What's your secret? Is your secret just to remain passionately in love with the cosmos? What keeps you driving to get out of bed in the morning?
Well, it is. I just find it fascinating. And I think it's a gift, like I said before, I think it was a gift of God that my mind is still functioning, you know, and that I'm very healthy, and my mind is still going. I've had no decrease it. I forget names sometimes. Forget your names, excuse me, but I find that, and the way I look at it, I don't object to people retiring. Like, you know, in David's case, he had to retire; it was a requirement. In our case, we have no such rule here. But look at David. David even, his mind keeps going. He's as active as ever right now. In fact, I think he's more active than he was when he was teaching. And so I don't hold it against people. They're in jobs that they want to stop and do nothing. But I just cannot sit on the beach and watch the waves come in. I enjoy it. I enjoy doing it. But I feel I have to. God gave me these gifts, and I have to use them the best I can, to my best ability, to lead. And that's my motto. I said, you know, on my tombstone, you can write that I did my very best. I gave it all that I had, and I did it all for the honor and glory of God. And what keeps me going.
Well, that's quite, what an extraordinary thought, Andy. He's done it all for the glory of God over all these 90 years, and one of the greatest pioneers I've ever had the privilege of working with and still work with. Giovanni. It just goes to show you that the human intellect, if used correctly, is a source not only of incredible knowledge and a well of truth, but Giovanni, also, it reminds me so much of the marvel and the wonder of simplicity, of just looking at one galaxy or just looking at one star and then reflecting back on your life as you do, as Andy does, as I do, and to see God's leading. You know, I'll never forget, Giovanni, just before we started collaborating, God gave me a verse in Isaiah, "I will give you the treasures of darkness." And that's when, you know, I started out my career in cosmic dust, not knowing where it would take me. You didn't know where the Spitzer Space Telescope would take you. But there's that enthusiasm, and it reminds me of the word enthusiasm, derived from the root entheos, meaning in God. And I think that's just where you're at.
Yeah, I agree. I fully agree, Dave. You said it beautifully. Yeah.
Well, gentlemen, I think on that note, reluctantly, I'm going to bring this conversation to a close. Professor David Block, Director of Reasons to Believe Africa, and our guest today on our very first podcast, Professor Giovanni Fazio. Thank you both for joining me today. God bless you.
Thank you very much, Andy, for this opportunity. I really enjoyed talking with you and David. It was a lot of fun, actually.
Thank you both so much. And it's just, as always, Giovanni, it's a singular joy and honor to have you on our first official podcast of Reasons to Believe Africa.
Thank you so much, David. You've been very good to me, and I really, really appreciate it. Tell Liz and the boys hello for me, and I miss seeing them and everything, and you too.
Oh, we'll meet again soon.
Yeah, okay. Take
care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, I really hope that you enjoyed this incredible interview and conversation between Dr. David Block, Dr. Andy Brow, and Dr. Giovanni Fazio. If you want to know more about David Block and his resources, as well as RTB Africa, I would invite you to follow RTB Africa on social media, and then also go to a YouTube channel called Professor David Block, where you can get all kinds of great video content featuring David Block. And I'm going to go ahead and bring today's podcast to a close by thanking you for your interest in what we're doing here at Reasons to Believe. I'm going to invite you to check out our website, again, reasons.org. I'm going to invite you to follow us on social media. We want to know your comments and your thoughts on today's episode, so please take advantage of the comment section to let us know what you think. And then also, again, remember to go to our YouTube channel, Reasons to Believe One, subscribe, use the notification button. Remember, before we end today's podcast, that the more we know about science, the more we have reasons to believe. Thank you.